would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Kirk from San Diego.
Aloha, everybody. I'm Kirk. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much for having me here, Jeff. I really appreciate it. And how about another round of applause for Nicole? Way to go, Nicole. Woo-hoo-hoo! And I know we had some new people, new or returning members. Welcome. I'm so glad you're here. Welcome, welcome, welcome. And our out-of-town visitors, welcome. And our 90-day, who was it? Ryan? Way to go, Ryan. All right. Woo-hoo! Woo-hoo! So like Nicole, let's get the formalities out of the way. My sobriety date is June 5th, 1992. My home group is Mount Soledad Men's. My sponsor goes there. Yeah, Dale Baker. My sponsor goes there. His sponsor goes there. My sponsor, my great-grand sponsor goes there. I got a bunch of sponsees that go there. And when I got here, I would not have believed any of that. If you told me I'd be standing here tonight, I got here when I was 28 years old, I'd have this many years without a drink or a drug, I probably would have flipped you off and left. I hear people say like they didn't fit in when they were little. I fit in when I was little. If you guys were doing anything, I was in. Whether it was sports or music or art or academics, man, I loved hanging out with people, you know. I've seen babies in recovery where their mothers are addicted and the babies come out addicted. And those babies are afraid right when they're born, like the mothers have been beaten up and in anger and violence. And the baby's spirits are already damaged. That wasn't my story. I came out perfectly whole when I was little, man. My spirit was alive and free. I didn't know anything about fear or doubt or guilt or shame. I didn't like walk around judging people or judging myself. None of that, man. My spirit was whole and perfect. And where I grew up, you know, my dad ruled our household with anger, violence, fear, intimidation. So by the time I was like 5 years old, man, I already had like some fear and doubt going on. And by the time I was 8 years old, man, I was super active. I played football, basketball, baseball, motocross. I fished, I hunted, I played the violin. I sang in a choir, in a church choir. I was in a band. I was a straight-A student. I mean, I did all this stuff. But I was terrified of my father. And these older kids in Huntington Beach where I was raised, they saw me literally afraid of my father. He was yelling at my mom. You could hear him across the street. And they said, drink this and smoke this and it'll be all right. And I had no problem, man. I took the joint and I took the bottle and I drank it and I smoked it. And my gosh, within 15 minutes, I was no longer afraid to go face the wrath of my father. I love the effect produced by alcohol and marijuana. And I would love to tell you from that moment on, I just made a right-hand turn and became like this lunatic alcoholic, but that isn't true. I really kind of went on this gradual curve. That was 8 years old the first time I tried it, and we moved down to Solana Beach when I was 11. In between 8 and 11, like, I smoked cigarettes a few times, I got stoned a couple times, I got drunk a few times, I smoked some PCP a couple times, did some reds, some cocaine, I fried on mushrooms, I took acid a couple times. See, my older brother was 6 years older, so when he would try it, and I was born at 11:45 p.m. on December 2nd, and he was born on December 3rd, so on his 6th birthday, I was the only present that he got. And he used to take me everywhere with him, everywhere. So I tried, and there used to be, I'm old, so back in my day, they had a Life cereal commercial. And they said, let's get Mikey, he'll try it, he'll try anything. And I was Mikey. They'd get me to try anything, because I'd do anything. And by the time I was 13 in junior high school, at Earl Warren Junior High School in Solana Beach, man, I knew the cool people partied. And I knew I was a partier. And like, I no longer, my father, I actually look very much like my father did. God rest his soul. And I swore, by 13, I swore I would never wear one of these or one of these. I swore. I had long hair, and I was a partier. You know, what happened was, think about it, the cool people partied. The cool people partied. And if you didn't party the way we did, you weren't cool, and we wouldn't hang out with you. You know, I really didn't trust people that didn't party. I mean, I just didn't trust you, you know. I had no idea I had an allergy to alcohol. I had no idea that once you put one drop in my body, that's all I would think about, and I would chase it. I was just like Nicole, man. I was a puker and a passer-outer from the get-go, man. 12, 13, 14, 15, I'm puking and passing out all the time. And I love to smoke a lot of pot. So really, I believed, in fact, I knew, I had a belief system. I knew in my heart, down to my core, that I would party and smoke killer green bud every day till the day I died. I just knew that, you know, I knew that. And what I didn't know, it's like the last time my father laid his hands on me was when I was 15 years old. Last time he touched me. And I got here when I was 28. So there was 13 years where literally not one bad thing. It wasn't random. I was never walking down a street and something bad just randomly happened to me. Never, never, ever. I created everything that happened. And I talk about, I used to be a fighter. I used to love to fight. And a friend of mine that's known me for over 40 years, he said, you need to quit talking about how much you fight and talk more about how much you used to get beat up. Because really, I was a fighter, but I used to get beat up a lot, you know. And there was a 12-year period where, you know, all those times I got beat up, I got fired from jobs, the girlfriend dumped me, I got arrested. I mean, I literally didn't know you could have a drunk in public. It was every time my drunk in public with assault on a police officer. Every single time. I didn't know, because that's what I would do. The cops, you know, I was really a menace to society. And trust me, I wanted all of you to think I had my shit together. You know, I acted like I was this preppy, cool dude who worked hard. And, you know, I went to college and I ended up working in restaurants and, you know, and I got good jobs. I mean, I'm really good out of the gate. I mean, I fly out of the gate and everybody goes, man, Kirk, he's a superstar. They promote me. They do all this stuff. And then the way I live my life, because really, I was drinking, smoking pot, doing any drug you had from the moment I woke up. I mean, in high school, I just loved to smoke pot and drink and party and just be crazy. And that behavior only gets you so far. I truly believe that because I was in the restaurant industry, that type of industry, there's a lot more partying, so it allowed me to do it longer. But what I didn't know was I had that allergy and I had this obsession. I didn't know I had an obsession. I mean, really, my obsession was so bad that all you had to do was tell me, hey, there's a party tomorrow. And you're coming. And it could be the morning, and I could be in a bad mood, and you told me, and I'm like, party tomorrow. And I just obsess about that part and be thinking about it, you know. But all that, you know, fine, the allergy, the obsession, you put anything in my body, and I'm going to chase it, and I obsess over partying. I mean, that's fine. But what I really did not know was that there was a spiritual malady inside of me. I had no idea I had a spiritual malady, which for me means when I was little, my spirit was whole and perfect, and my dad started damaging it. He did, you know. God bless him. I blamed him for years. I do have to tell you, if my dad would have been the sweetest, kindest, loving man, I'd still be here tonight. I'd still be here. It wasn't his fault. I blamed him all those years. But he started it, and literally, I took all this action to damage my own spirit. I took all this action. I mean, like Nicole said, I'm not going to tell you all my war stories. My war stories are horrible. I mean, I was carrying a firearm when I was 14, acting like I'm a preppy kid, carrying a firearm at 14, pulling armed robberies at 15, you know, doing all of the, I mean, just shady. I was a con man, bullshit artist who just like, you know, I would lie when the truth would have served me better. I would steal when I had no business stealing, when I had money in my pocket, you know. And like I said, I just thought I was a cool partier. And, you know, by 25, I was a sous chef of a restaurant up in Carlsbad. And sous chef's like the number two guy. There's an executive chef and a sous chef. And I had a really good job. And I was a lunatic. I'm working like 70 hours a week and just partying constantly. And if you came and sat at my oyster bar and I was working and you talked about going and scoring drugs from your dealer, I mean, I would get someone to cover my shift and I would follow you to your dealer's house, case out his house for 2 weeks, and then I'd go rob him, you know, and... And you know, I tell you that with no sense of pride whatsoever, because really, you know, if we backtrack to when I was in sixth grade, right before we moved down, I was going to a school called Hawthorne Christian School in Fountain Valley, California. And it was a really, really hard school. And I was actually, they had for sixth grade, they had a valedictorian. I was a star athlete. I was a valedictorian. And they had this little, like, walk of fame in the principal's office. And the principal called me in the office and said, Kirk, what do you want to be when you grow up? And this is my truly what I wanted to be when I was 11 years old in sixth grade. I said, I want to be a doctor, a lawyer, a professional football player, and the president of the United States. And I seriously wanted that. And this principal didn't laugh like we laugh now. The principal said, those are great goals, Kirk. See these people on the wall? There was like a governor, a couple of doctors and lawyers, senator, there were all these people that had gone to this school that had made their dreams come true. And this principal said, just keep doing what you're doing and you can be anything you want. You can do anything you want with your life. And I chose to use those gifts to be a punk, to be a punk. And remember, I didn't know I was a punk. I thought I was a cool partier. I didn't know that this thing in here was so friggin' damaged. I had to pour so much alcohol and drugs on top of it just to be okay. You know, you hear them say in meetings, partying was fun, and then it was fun with problems, and then it was nothing but problems. Mine was like fun with problems right from the beginning. And that just went fun with problems to fun with really bad problems that I just tried to hide from everybody. To fun with really bad problems that I couldn't hide from anybody. To just a friggin' mess. I mean, just a mess. Because my dad died when I was 25 and I was a sous chef up at the Rain Tree in Carlsbad. And literally, I had a one-minute rule. I had a one-minute rule from about the time I was 18. Within 1 minute of waking up, I had to put something in my body. Whether it be a cigarette, a bong hit, a line, I had to put something in my body. And I had to keep something in my body all the time. If I started to come like down a little bit, I had to put something else in there, you know. And when my dad died, you know, I had been given all these tools on to how to succeed out there. Where I come from, you fight, you compete, you succeed, you win. You achieve, you accomplish, and you acquire. You know, you achieve, you accomplish, and you acquire. And there's big shoes to fill in my family. My family's full of doctors and lawyers and people that have lots of money. You know, big things to live up to, you know. And my, like, self-doubt and my, like, guilt and shame wasn't about living up to other people's expectations of myself. They were, like, I wasn't living up to my own expectations. And I didn't know it. Remember, I'm just a cool partier who's out there, you know, being a wild man. And, you know, because other things, you know, I learned quick around here in the beaches of Southern California, if you can fight, you can party, you can play sports, and you can get girls, you're the man. So I made sure I could do those four things very well, you know. And those really don't serve you well in society, you know. So within 6 months of my dad dying in 1989, I went from being a sous chef to being a line cook at another restaurant, which is like a step back in your career. And then 6 months after that, I'm like a breakfast cook at another restaurant. And 6 months after that, I'm a graveyard. When I hit bottom, I mean, I don't know about any of you all, but when I hit bottom, I just lower my standards and I move to someplace they don't know me. You know, and I move from Encinitas to San Marcos. You know, just lower my standards and go to San Marcos. No offense to y'all from San Marcos. But I started being, you know, all of a sudden I'm a graveyard cook at a dive 24-hour restaurant. It's just a dive family restaurant. And Because see, all these tools my family gave me to succeed out there, they didn't give me any spiritual tools, you know, no spiritual tools, how to take care of the spirit, you know. When bad stuff would happen, my mom was like really good about school and working hard and doing, I mean, I can go work 80 hours a week for 50 weeks straight in a row, no problem. But this thing's damaged and all I knew was pour alcohol and drugs on top of it. That's all I knew, you know. And that's what I did after my dad died. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm a graveyard cook at this restaurant where I called everybody that worked there lowlifes, you know, no offense to them, but that's what my head said. And all of a sudden, this kitchen manager, who, you know, I swear I had forgotten more about cooking than this guy would ever know, he calls me into his office and he's like, you know what, Kirk, you're a great guy, but I'm going to have to let you go. You're a mess. You need to get some help. And he wasn't the first person that told me that. You know, I'd had numbers of girlfriends and bosses tell me that before. And you know, after I was all indignant and saying, you know, do you know who I am? You know, you need three guys. You know, you need three guys to replace me when I'm not working. I'm the best cook you got, you know. And he said, you know what? You're right. We at least need two plus the dishwasher. But that's when you're not trying to sleep with my waitresses, when you're not trying to beat up my customers, or when you're not leaving to go rob some drug dealer, you know. And within like 45 days, actually, right like that same week, I went to the Metallica concert at the San Diego Sports Arena. It was like February 13th, 1992. And we went to the Red Onion down in PB. And I don't remember any of the concert, but I do have a picture. I do have a picture. I've got a picture. I've got a picture. This is me in the drunk tank. At the San Diego Sports Arena, I never saw the concert. That's my friend holding up my hair, and I don't remember. And I woke up the next morning not remembering everything, and there's a Polaroid next to me on the carpet, my friend's carpet, with a big puddle of puke. And here, you can pass that around. So I should have just showed you that 10 minutes ago, 15 minutes ago, and we could have got to the recovery. But like I said, I didn't know that, like, my spirit was damaged inside. And, I hated myself. I think you mentioned it. I hated myself inside, you know. And I used to walk around talking shit to myself about myself like I wasn't good enough. You know, you're no good. And within a month of that picture, I was homeless. I was living in a 1978 Ford Courier truck. The thing was the biggest piece of shit on the planet. It barely ran. And I had this girlfriend who was still there and two dogs living in this thing. And all of a sudden, I was homeless, you know. And me and homeless don't work well. I don't look good. And I'm drinking and I'm drugging. And that's the problem with me and alcohol is, alcohol takes away the pain. And it makes the life today, which would have been completely unacceptable 2 weeks ago, bearable. It makes it bearable. And I was stealing booze from stores. I was stealing food from stores. I was wearing a trench coat, and I had this long, that hair is really, when it's not washed, and I wasn't washed, and I was missing teeth, and I was bloody, and I did not like myself. And on June 3rd of 1992, I was in a park up in Vista, right near the Vista Courthouse, where, like, in 1991, I had done 30 days in the Vista Court, in that Vista jail, I'm right in the park, and I'm drinking, and I'm doing crystal meth. This girlfriend ended up moving in with a dealer, and so she would bring me drugs and food and take care of our dogs. And she'd just cry most of the time when she got there and saw me. And I'm doing everything possible, and it didn't take away the pain. One day, it didn't take away the pain, you know. It didn't take it away. It's okay, you can laugh. I've got a saying, I don't care if you're laughing at me or laughing with me, as long as you're laughing. But it would not take away the pain. And I cried out like a baby, help me, help me, help me. And God damn it, wouldn't you know, within 24 hours I'm being brought to you people. And you guys welcomed me. You guys welcomed me. You know, no one had been welcoming me before. I mean, if you've ever been homeless or been down and out on the street, people look at you with pity, with disgust, and with fear that's it. There's no other way you look at that, that I got looked at, you know. And I wouldn't look people in your eyes. I mean, if someone had their shit going on, I wouldn't look them in the eyes, man. I could tell you what everybody's shoes look like. Everybody's, because I was looking down, talking shit about myself to myself. And I got here, and you know what? I wasn't an alcoholic. I thought alcoholics were wimps. If you told me I had a problem with crystal meth and pot, maybe, you know, and... The big thing was you guys welcomed me, and I ended up started going to La Mesa Men's. It was like one of the first meetings. I was actually in a treatment center. Like, I got help, and I said, I was indignant talking to my mom and my oldest brother. That oldest brother, the six-year-older, he's the one I called. He brought me to my mom, and I had been banned from my mom's house because I had broken in and robbed her with a shotgun, sawed-off shotgun, ski mask and ski gloves. And she came home while I was there, and she said, "Kirk, get out of my house." She knew right away I've got all this stuff. She says, and then like a month after that, no, it's probably a couple months after that, I showed up at her door when I was homeless, knocking, and she opened. You could hear the deadbolt and opened it, and the chain was on it, and she was weeping, and she put a $50 bill through the door and said, "If you ever come here again, I'm calling the police." And then she shut it and turned the lock, and I turned to walk away back to that piece of shit truck, and bump started. It only bump started, and you could hear her sobbing at the top of her lungs, man. It broke my heart. It hurts right now. I can feel it. But they took me to a hospital. I was indignant when I got to their house. I said, "What are you going to take me to, ANA?" And my mom said, "No, we're going to take you to a hospital. You need to be hospitalized." Because I was 145 pounds when I got here. I'm about 205 right now, so I was 60 pounds lighter than I am now. I was not doing well. And they brought me to this treatment center, McDonald's Center, over in La Jolla. And that's where you guys welcomed me. And they started vanning us, and they vanned us to La Mesa Men's. And you realize, I'd sit in meetings, and really at the beginning... at the beginning when I got here, you know, when guys like me, my apologies on my language, guys like me, if I saw a guy like me talking in a meeting, I'd just say, "Yeah, asshole, he doesn't know anything about partying, because look at the way I look." But it was like I'd sit in the rooms when I was new, and like 90% of the time I'd be like, "Could you just shut up and let me get back to playing ping pong?" Because they had a ping pong table, right? But then all of a sudden, you know, after a week, I'd kind of like hear a little bit. And then it was only like 50% of the time I was saying, you know, "Shut up." And, you know, and it started to change. And they brought me to, this guy vanned me and they took us in a van to La Mesa Men's. And I went out, this guy, Bob Palmer, who became my first sponsor. He was my sponsor for the first 6 years. And they, you know, they invite... the meeting before the meeting at the meeting, and the meeting after the meeting. And Bob and his cronies, these old dudes, realized I was 28, and these guys were old, man. They were really old. They were ancient. In fact, they were younger than I am now, but they were old, you know. And we'd go out afterwards, and I'd listen to their stories, man, and I'd be like, these guys used to be crazy, and they're not. You know, they're not. I'm like, shit, this stuff might work for me, you know. This stuff might work for me. And I'm good. I'm really, really good at social AA, you know. You go to meetings, you hang out, you drink coffee, we all go do socials. I'm really, really, I'm good at that, man. If that's all it took to get recovery, man, I would be the number one in the class, I guarantee you. But all of a sudden, I was sitting in rooms, and Bob was my sponsor, but I wasn't doing anything. And I start going... I'm talking shit. My first sign that I'm not doing well is I start talking shit about myself, and I start talking to myself about myself, right? And then I start talking shit about you all to myself. "Ah, look at that motherfucker." You know, I start doing that. And all of a sudden, man, I'm doing that, and all of a sudden I'm like, you know what? I'm good. I think I can split. You know, I think I can go back to where I know, you know. I think I can go back. Because what really happened also, this was the key. I heard... the third tradition, it said, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I was at a speaker meeting, and I'm like, holy shit. I was actually sitting like right up in here, and it was that La Jolla speakers meeting when it used to have lots of people at it, lots of people. And I heard the tradition, and I get up, and I'm like, psh, I'm out of here. I don't have a desire to stop drinking. I'm gone. And Bob had driven the van, and he stopped me. And he said, where are you going, Mr. Happy? I'm like, I just heard this tradition. I don't have a desire to stop drinking. He's like, let me get you a cup of coffee, and then you can leave. I was going to walk back to this treatment center, pack my shit, and leave. You know. And I tell him, he's all, hold on, didn't this happen, this happen, this happen? Tell me more. I told him this, and he goes, well, did you actually hear the tradition? A desire to stop drinking. He goes, it doesn't say your desire. He goes, it sounds like the County of San Diego, the San Diego Police Department, the IRS, a whole bunch of girlfriends, a whole bunch of employers, all your family members have a desire for you to stop drinking. I was like, damn it. I turned around and went back in, you know. And I actually started getting busy because you know, you hear that thing, and I hear things funny, you know. I don't know what people say. I just know what I hear. And I hear in kind of like a weird language. It's like, you know, it's just, there's really, really, you know, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length, you know, I hear it that way, you know. And I used to be like, please, you know, the only thing I wanted was your car, your money, and your girlfriend. That was it, you know. But when I hung out with Bob and his cronies, man, these guys had a sense and strength of spirit that I had lost long ago. And no amount of alcohol or drugs or work or money or her or whatever was bringing it back. And that's what I wanted. I didn't want to stop drinking and partying. I wanted that sense of, I wanted that, you know. So I had to get in the steps, you know. I got in the steps. And you know, we get to the second step over here. And you know, power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Restore, Bob told me, place it like a previous state of sanity. I told him, no, I've been insane my whole life. He goes, no, think all the way back. Ah, I was 8 years old. I was this happy kid. I did everything. I liked people. I wasn't a liar and a cheat and a thief yet, you know. And he goes, yeah, it can restore you to that sanity. And he told me some of his story, and it had restored him to that sanity. We got to the third step, and I said, F you, I'm out of here. I knew it was a cult. I do not believe in God. I do not believe in God. And he goes, it doesn't say you got to believe in God. The only place that says you have to believe in anything is you came to believe that a power greater than yourself could restore you to sanity in step two. You already told me you believe if you hang out with us, because my power greater than myself was this room. All you guys, if my car does not stop when I go to leave here, I can't push it very, very far, but all you guys can push me as far as I need to go. You're much more powerful than me. That was my first power greater than myself. And Bob told me at step three, he goes, that's cool. If you want to leave because you don't believe in God, that's cool. Just don't talk shit about AA that it doesn't work. And all I thought was, how the hell did he know I was going to talk shit about AA that it doesn't work? Because I was definitely going to. And he goes, because it's a 12-step program. It's a 12-step program. You have to go through all 12 steps to get the effect. And he goes, kid, he used to call me kid. He'd slap me on the shoulder. Kid, you're only on step 2.5. Why don't you give yourself a shot to go through all 12 steps and have a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps? Don't believe anything. You don't have to be happy about doing it. You don't have to believe shit. Just do it. And when you get to the end, then you can judge if it works or not. And if it don't work and you don't like it, you can split then. But don't leave and talk shit about AA. And I made up my mind right then, okay, motherfucker, I'm going to go. I'm sorry, I didn't say that to him, I just thought this. I didn't say it to him, no. I thought it, I'm going to go through the 12 steps, and when I get to the end, I'm flipping you off and I'm out of here. That's what I made that decision. And I went through, you know, all of a sudden, where he's holding my hands, and in how it works, it says, we asked his protection and care with complete abandon. He goes, we asked? That's a direct order. You're supposed to do that. And he's holding my hand, and we're saying, we ask your protection and care with complete abandon. We ask your protection and care with complete abandon. And actually, I should tell you, 10 seconds before that, I said, we ask your protection and care with complete abandon. He goes, is that complete abandon? Is that complete abandon? What's complete abandon? And all of a sudden he held my hand. And that's when I said it. We ask your protection and care with complete abandon. That means all my friggin' heart. All my friggin' heart. And then we get to the third step prayer on page 63. And it says, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. And I tell you to this day, every person in here, we all love remarkable. I love remarkable. And my apologies, I know them, but I'm going to tell you what the remarkable things they tell you are. It says, we enjoyed peace of mind. I had no peace of mind before I got here. It says, we discovered we could face life successfully. I was not facing life successfully before I got here. It says, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. I would have told you before I got here I had no fear, but bull effing shit, I was full of fear, right? So all of a sudden, I'm sincerely saying the third step prayer, right? And right at the bottom of that page, it says, when humbly, honestly and humbly made an effect, sometimes a very great one was felt at once. And I said it with sincerity and humbly and honestly. They all mean the same thing as complete abandon. With all my friggin' heart, everything I got. And realize I didn't believe in this God. And I said this prayer. And then he opened up the 12 and 12. And actually the serenity prayer is on page 41 in the third step of the 12 and 12. But at the end it says, thy will not mine be done. It goes through the serenity prayer, thy will not mine be done. So all of a sudden, I'm saying these three prayers with all my heart. And I felt something inside of me. I felt like lighter, better, that I knew there was a little bit of hope. You know, there was a little bit of hope. And the problem with that is on the bottom of that page after the third step, it says, next we launched on a course of vigorous action. And he goes, what does vigorous mean? Whoo, man, boom, vigorous, go, go, go. And we jumped right into the four step, you know. And I wrote my columns, you know, and you know, talked about causes and conditions, which is like the psychology part. Thanks. And then in the four step, there's actually five more prayers. There's two resentment prayers. There's a fear prayer. And there's two sex prayers, sex and behavior prayers. And there's a meditation on the bottom of page 69. For resentment, they give you two prayers. They give you two resentment prayers right in the big book on page 67. For fear on page 68, they give you a fear prayer. And I had all these resentments, man, all these resentments. So he has me reading this list. In fact, I've got my first four step was about 44 pages long. I've got my current one. This is my current one. My whole thing. One page, resentments, fears, and my sex inventory. And I got five resentments. They're all small. It's the mother of my daughter, my mother, my daughter who's 15. Anybody 15-year-old daughter, you know about that. She finally made her first four step. My wife, yeah. My wife and myself, right? And I still keep, just like Bob Palmer had me break it out, and say, I'd look at it and say, God, help me show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience. We would cheerfully grant a sick friend. This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to them? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. Because see, it says in this book that we pick up this kit of spiritual tools. Tools to take care of my spirit. My old tools were working, fighting, partying, avoiding all this shit. Now it gives me these prayers. And then there's a prayer for fear. Today I have a fear that I'll die before my daughter is an adult. My father died at 50. My grandfather died at 52. And my great-grandfather at 48. I'm 54. My daughter's 14. It's hereditary. This cancer's hereditary. Right? It's a fear. It's small. It's small fear. But I still break it out. And I look at it. Ah. God, remove our fear and direct our attention to what you would have us be. The cool thing is, if you look at the four step, it has you write them. And then it has you say these prayers, and then after that, when you say the resentment prayers, after you say the prayers, it says, we learn to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. So I used to be resentful at these motherfuckers, right? Because they did all this shit. And just writing down that four step, thank you very much, and sharing it with my sponsor ain't going to make the resentment go away. I'm going to have to pray. And then I'm going to have to meditate. On the bottom of page 69, it says, in meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. So I still to this day look, this guy did me wrong. What should I do about each specific matter? What should I do about each specific matter? What should I do about each specific matter? And then it tells us, if sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves harder into helping others. I got good news and bad news for you. Everyone in here, sex is very troublesome for you. Everyone. Very rarely is it perfect, right at that? Very rarely. But it tells me, throw myself the harder into helping others. Get into service. Right there in the fourth step. Get into service. So Bob Palmer had me doing all this bullshit, right? Going to meetings. I mean, I had this big problem. That girlfriend moved in with the dealer, and then she got pregnant, and all of a sudden I'm all bunched up about it. I had left that place and gone to a 90-day sober living. And he says, meet me at La Mesa Men's. Early, like an hour and a half early. I get there, he's making the coffee. I got to talk to him about this. I got to talk to him, right? And he goes, I know exactly what you need. See all those chairs over there? Go set them all up. And there was a lot of chairs, you know. And by the end of the meeting, I had forgotten what my problem was. I'd forgotten about it, you know. And I ended up going through all the steps with Bob. I ended up going all through. And I made amends to my mother. They're in the ninth step, it tells you service. Page 77, it says you get into service. Page 79, there's the ninth step prayer. Give me the strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. And then there's a ninth step meditation on page 83. It says, in the morning, we ask that we be shown the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. So I start saying all this little bullshit, right? All this. And I go to boatloads of meetings. That first year, I went to 1,100 meetings. 1,100. I had nothing to do. I was unemployable. I went to 3 meetings a day. Boatload of meetings. I did a boatloads of prayer, boatloads of service. And at the end, Bob called me and invited me to his house. He had never invited me to his house before. And he said, yeah, check it out. Brought me in front of this big old mirror. And he said, see that guy right there? And I look, who? He goes, you, dummy, you. He goes, you've had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. And he was right. My spirit had healed. Healed. I had never had spiritual tools to heal this. All the spiritual tools I used before I got here, they were all this temporary bullshit that really didn't heal it. They really were fucking breaking it more. And I'd love to tell you that from that moment on, I just skyrocketed and I've just been a spiritual lightning bolt the whole entire time. Well, that would be a lie. All of a sudden, by the end of that first year, I was employable and I had been working just enough to like pay for my bills that first year. And then I got a job and I went back and worked at this company that has said, you can never come here again. If you ever come into any one of our restaurants, we will call the police on you. And I went back and that first year I started as a prep cook for them. I had been a sous chef for them too. I had started as a prep cook and I worked my way up. And all of a sudden, second year I get a job and they relocate me to open up a new restaurant. Second year I went to 750 meetings. Third year I only went to 100 meetings. 100 meetings. And I became crazy again. Crazy. Didn't drink. Crazy. And what do I do when I get crazy and all of a sudden it's either brought to my attention or I recognize it? I run right back to you guys. Run right back and I jump right in the middle. Jump right in the middle. So really that first 8 years was kind of this chase jobs, chase relationships, you know. AA wasn't always the primary thing. Only when my ass was falling off then it was. And then after 9/11 I decided, you know what, I want a family. And I moved back to San Diego. That's when Soledad Men's 2001 became my home group. Got a sponsor, Dave Moore. He got me right into H&I. Thank you for mentioning H&I. Thank you for your service. I appreciate it. I don't know if the place you talked about was SARP, but I love SARP, if that's it. I love SARP. I was a coordinator for the hospital side of H&I. For 2.5 years, and I remember when SARP called and asked for a meeting, and I used to go there every Wednesday night for a year, and I'd have to wait at the gate, and then the duty guy would have to come and pick me up, and then I have to wait. It took 3.5 hours just to do the 1 hour meeting. Sometimes they wouldn't pick me up, but you know that snowballed that, and then the second year I started doing the triple threat meeting, and then it snowballed. You know, it's an amazing, amazing place, and. There's been a lot of stuff. So since 2001, it's been, 17 years where Soledad's been my home group. And, man, I don't think I've done under 500 meetings in any 1 year since then. I do at least like 50, 60, 70 H&I meetings a year, I believe. I have a weekly H&I meeting. I'm really fucking sick, pardon my language. I mean, I need it bad. And I sponsor a whole boatload of guys. I live up in LA, or I live here and I work up in LA now. So I go to about 7 meetings from Monday to Thursday up in LA. I just go to meetings and meetings and meetings and work. And I got a wife and, like I said, a 14-year-old daughter. Life is incredible. One thing I realized, and it was told to me early, man, why be sober if it's not going to be fun as shit and if we're not going to make our wildest dreams come true, right? Why not? I mean, if I want my life to kind of be lame and like not live up to like my potential, I may as well be a derelict like I used to be, you know. But here, what I've seen here is everything is possible. I'm 54 years old. I mean, I'm an old frickin' man, you know. And, sorry. It's just me. No, you're much younger than me. And, you know, that's a lot of years. It's a lot of years, and I've done a lot. I've traveled. I mean, I've gone to, you know, if you ever travel, please find AA. Find AA. I go to AA everywhere I go. And what I've started to do really in like the past 8 or 9 years is I'll call early before I travel, and I'll go and I'll do H&I where I travel in the cities I travel. So I'm going up to Seattle, and I already got, next week I'm going to Seattle. I already got 2 H&I meetings. They've invited me to 2 H&I meetings, and that's just bitching, you know. You are looking at a selfish, self-centered prick, man. I used to think life has to be all about me, you know. But if I make life all about you guys and helping, really, my thing is I like to help men, young men, or any man that doesn't know how to stay sober and get sober. I like to take him through the steps just like Bob took me through and watch his life change and skyrocket into something in like miraculous, you know. There's a bitchin' life out there for each and every one. An amazing life for each and every one of us, you know. Like I said, I got a lot of years behind me, but I can guarantee you, the best seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years of my life are in front of me. I can guarantee you that as long as I stay with you, you know. I used to think alcohol and drugs, I thought my dad was my problem and then maybe alcohol and drugs, you know. Then maybe crystal or whatever. But the book says lack of power is my dilemma, lack of power. On my own power, I can't get through life for long periods of time successfully. Some reason I sabotage it and drink and I just fuck it all up, right? But when I connect to you guys and get power from you guys, and I get power from this God, and we all get power from this God, and we're on the same wavelength, holy shit, I got power. I've seen in my recovery, just these last 5 years, I can get through anything sober and happy. Amazing shit sober and happy, you know. You'll hear in rooms, God will never give you more than you can handle. Bull fucking shit. Bullshit. God constantly gave me more than I can handle. That's why I drank and drugs so much. That's why. I'm not kidding you. But I can guarantee each and every one of you, God will never give us more than we can handle. Together, we can handle it. You know? Once again, all you new people, welcome. Welcome, man. My phone number, if anybody wants, any of you men, if you want to have the most amazing life and get taken through the steps in a short period of time and watch your life change and turn around, I am happy to help anybody. I got a boatload of sponsees, but I can always take more. You know, and I got a boatload of guys that'll help you and a couple of friends right here. My phone number, anybody ever wants to call you, my phone number is 619-944-0914. I've had that number for 17 years. I will have that number till the day I die. Welcome everybody, man. I hope you find the most miraculous life like I have here. Thank you for giving this to me. Aloha.